From the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism, this is Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. One of the hardest regions of the world to be lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender is the Arab world. In Saudi Arabia, the punishment for the crime of sodomy is death by stoning. In Sudan, punishments for same-sex intercourse include flogging. And many countries impose prison sentences. Also challenging is the fact that the stigma associated with being LGBT is so great, many people feel they can't come out even to their family or closest friends. Now, during the Arab Spring in 2011 and 2012, many activists in the Arab world saw an opening to advance LGBT rights amid a climate of greater freedoms. 5 years later, some are concerned that window has closed. Still, other activists say the Middle East isn't the cauldron of homophobia it's often portrayed as in Western media. On this edition of Global Journalist, we look at the uncertain lives of LGBT people in Arab countries. We're going to start by talking to Salim Haddad in London. He's the Jordanian-born author of Guapa, a new and widely praised novel. It tells the story of a young man in an unnamed Middle East country forced out of the closet after his grandmother catches him in bed with another man. Salim Haddad, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us just a little bit about what inspired you to write a novel on this subject.
Well, I've always wanted to write a novel that had a gay character that looked at gay life in the Middle East. You know, being gay myself and growing up in the Middle East, I didn't really see myself represented on both in English and literature and movies and TV, but also Arabic literature and movies and television. And so I wanted to portray a realistic and sympathetic perspective to gay life and culture. And I think in 2011, when the Arab Spring happened, I felt that it was a good lens through which to explore some of these issues, this idea of a sexual awakening, you know, and this idea of coming out of the closet mirrored a lot in my eyes some of the protests and this, you know, people going out in the street after a long period of frustration and anger.
Well, tell us just a little bit about your own personal experiences growing up gay. You grew up in Jordan. Your family moved around elsewhere in the 1990s. Tell us just a little bit about that. What are some of the challenges that you experienced?
So I think it's important to preface this by saying that, you know, the challenges that you face vary so much by your class, by whether you live in a city or in a rural area, what country you grew up in, how much political power you have. For me, I think the hardest thing, I come from quite a mixed background. My mother's half German, half Iraqi. My father's Palestinian Lebanese, half Muslim and half Christian. And so I think while I came from a liberal family, I was still struggling quite a bit around broader issues of masculinity and ideals of how a man should behave in society. That for me was the harshest, was the thing that I struggled with the most, rather than specifically saying it was my gay identity that I was, that I felt was under attack. It was more this ideal of masculinity that I wasn't necessarily fulfilling.
And how did your family react to this idea?
It took a long time. I mean, when I told them I had decided to move to London, I felt I needed more space to explore myself. And I was living in Amman at the time, which is a pretty small capital city. And they took it very difficult at first. It was a challenging time. They were living in Abu Dhabi, and they flew me out to for a few days to speak to them. But I think now, after a lot of conversation and them meeting my partner and having very honest conversation over a long period of time, I think we've come to a very good place. I think they're accepting, and so I feel quite fortunate.
You wrote a piece in the Daily Beast earlier this year. I thought it was really interesting. You talk about how many Arabs may engage in sort of same-sex intercourse but not have an identity as being gay or as being lesbian. And you talk about a boyfriend breaking up with you because you were sort of so open about your sexuality. Tell us just a little bit about that sort of distinction.
I don't think it's a distinction that's limited to the Middle East, to be honest. I mean, I think the way people express their sexualities people express their sexualities in very different ways, often beyond these simplistic labels of LGBT. And I think in the Middle East, that's also the case, and maybe perhaps a bit more so. because this idea of a gay identity is something that is definitely seen as coming from the West. That's not to say that it is something that is rejected. I don't necessarily agree with that. But I think it's something that shouldn't necessarily be assumed to exist out of nothing.
In your novel, you also talk about how there are these misconceptions in the West about what it means to be gay and Arab or gay and living in the Middle East. You've written about sort of the exaggerated way this can affect sort of perceptions of the Middle East and be used even in politics. Talk to us just a little bit about that.
Well, what I was talking about and what I really wanted to try and bring out and examine in my novel is the impact of these wider narratives on individual lives. So when you're talking about the struggles facing LGBT people in the Middle East, these discussions are not happening in a vacuum. These discussions are happening in an environment where there's much larger anti-Arab and anti-Muslim discourse, and there are often governments that are using these discourses to legitimate and promote political and military objectives in the region, which might harm citizens, including LGBT citizens. And so I wanted to raise that as an issue.
Well, one of the episodes that you also had written about was took place in Lebanon. I think it was in 2012. There was a series of police raids on cinemas that had been sort of cruising areas for gay men. Lebanon, of course, is one of the sort of more tolerant and liberal places as it comes to LGBT rights. And I should add that one of these episodes was actually filmed by a Lebanese television program. What are some of the lessons of these incidents? What impact did they have?
I mean, the narrative that Lebanon is more accepting around LGBT rights is the situation in Lebanon is a lot more complicated than that. And that's another example where I think Lebanon and Beirut especially is often held as a beacon of hope for LGBT people. But then a lot of it depends on what class you're from, what part of the country you're living in. And so what I wanted to raise with the LGBT raids in Lebanon is that they tend to be targeted in lower class areas and in spaces where gay or same-sex practicing individuals who are of a lower class who are not able to buy themselves into the upscale bars in Beirut, they often go to cinemas and bathhouses. And these are the places that are not safe. They're the places that are targeted by police. Whereas you have gay bars and clubs in Beirut that are quite expensive to get into, and you'd rarely, if ever, have police raids on those places.
Well, Salim Haddad, thanks so much for joining us today on Global Journalist.
Thank you very much for having me.
I want to remind you that you're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. We're talking today about the extraordinary difficulties of LGBT people in the Arab world. Of course, the Arab world is not monolithic, and it encompasses both the flashy nightclubs of Beirut and the Islamic extremists of ISIS. Now, to broaden our discussion, we're going to bring in three other guests. Joining us from New York is Graham Reed. He's the director of the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Rights Program at Human Rights Watch. In Manama, the capital of Bahrain, is Esra El-Shafi. She's the director of Mideast Youth, a network of online platforms that amplify marginalized voices in the region. She's also one of the founders of Awa.org, an online space for LGBT issues in the Middle East. Now, for those of you watching the video cast of our program, she's asked that her face not be shown for security reasons. Our final guest is Anton Issa in Washington, D.C. He's a senior editor at the Middle East Institute who has written extensively about these issues. Welcome to all of you. Graham Reed, I wanted to start with you. Give us just an overview of how LGBT rights have been changing in the Mideast over the past 5 to 6 years.
Yes, and you know, I'd like to pick up also on what Salim is saying, is that of course there's not one uniform experience of being LGBT within the region, and there are class dynamics and also depending where you live that would shape your experience. We've worked at Human Rights Watch, we've worked in a number of countries, including Egypt, Tunisia, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Kuwait, Morocco. And the experience in each place is, of course, very specific to that country setting. I'd like to pick up on something that Salim said about Lebanon, because that's an area where we've worked. We did a report in 2013 that included the raids that you mentioned on the cinemas. And what we were focusing on are the abuses that people experience in detention, not just LGBT people, but other marginalized populations as well. And our most recent report has focused on the phenomenon of forced anal testing, which was also used in Lebanon, in Egypt and Tunisia, as a form of police in cooperation with medical personnel undergoing tests allegedly to prove homosexual conduct. Now, these tests
I mean, this
are
sounds
medically...
like this sounds like almost like sexual assault by police.
That is what we are arguing in our report, is that in certain instances it amounts to a form of sexual assault and certainly is regarded as a form of torture. Lebanon, the Lebanese Order of Physicians in 2012 issued a directive to stop the practice, and there was also a Ministry of Justice communication to stop it. That doesn't mean it stopped altogether. There's still instances in which this has been used. But it's a particularly pernicious and abusive practice.
Well, Graham, let me stop you there because I want to come back to this issue. But first, I'd like to turn the conversation to Esra Al-Shafi. First of all, just tell us, if you would, why it is that you don't like having your face shown when talking about these issues.
Well, my physical anonymity is very important to me. Bahrain is a very small country. It's not just for my physical safety, but it's also for the safety of my family. I'm very outspoken about a wide range of issues apart from LGBT rights. And it's just for the sake of my long-term security, and it helps me stay out of prison. So
well,
that's
the
main
reason. Tell us just a little bit about your website, ahwa.org. Why did you decide to found it?
Well, being queer in the Middle East, particularly in the Gulf region, it can be a very isolating experience. But the internet served as a gateway to freedom of speech, and I found enormous potential in using it to create a place where we felt that we belong. So about 6 years ago, shortly before the Arab Spring, I founded a discussion platform called Ahwa, which is the Arabic word for passions. And it's a place where LGBT youth in the Arab world can go to find a supportive community that can relate to the fears, the issues, and challenges that come with being queer in the region. And we have grown to be a couple of thousand members strong, and people have often taken those interactions offline for meetups and physical spaces where we don't experience the intense loneliness and the crippling silence that we did before the internet came about.
And Anton Issa in Washington, D.C., tell us just, if you would, about how sort of the struggle for LGBT rights over the past few years has been sort of related to the push for other human and democratic rights in the Arab world.
Well, as you mentioned earlier, the Arab Spring kind of opened a bit of space for a push on a variety of issues, including LGBT issues. And what we've seen over the last few years is LGBT movements kind of move within this broader pro-democracy kind of movement or pro-reform movement on a grassroots level in Egypt, in Lebanon, in Turkey to some degree as well. It's received a bit of a backlash. It's the result of that is that homosexuality or sexuality in general has now become a focal point politically between conservative forces and progressive forces, between those who wish to protect the status quo in terms of the autocratic system of government, the deep state, and so forth, the military forces, as well as those who and against those who want change. And that has been the consequence of that, and that's where we sit today.
And Graham Reed, I want to come back to you to sort of continue where we left off with the issue of forced anal examinations. You were speaking about Lebanon. I believe this practice has also taken place in Tunisia, Egypt. What are these some of the more difficult Arab countries for LGBT people? Like we'd mentioned earlier, we'd perceive Lebanon as being particularly tolerant. Give us just a little overview of that.
Well, certainly in Egypt, these tests are used routinely. And there's been an enormous clampdown, particularly under Sisi, targeting transgender women and gay men. The reports are that there are more than 200 people who have been arrested and prosecuted under their vague laws of insulting public morals or debauchery laws. And it's a kind of moral panic that is used to distract attention away from other issues, in which the government presents itself as the guardians of public virtue. So LGBT people get caught up in this broader conflict that's taking place within Egypt in the context of the crush of opposition, protests being effectively banned, the clampdown of civil society. So LGBT people get caught up in that and provide some kind of moral justification for the government there, who are present themselves as kind of guarding public morals. Certainly we've seen in Tunisia the same tests that have been used. In Tunisia,
We should say the idea behind the test is that in order to be prosecuted, you sort of have to be caught in the act, and in the absence of catching someone in the act of having intercourse, these forced anal examinations are used as evidence in criminal trials. Is that right?
That's exactly the case.
And sorry, continue if you would, about Tunisia.
Well, in Tunisia, there's an organization there, Shams, that was given permission to operate, although subsequently the government issued instructions for them to suspend their activities. But nevertheless, you know, there are groups within several countries who are operating in order to advance LGBT rights within the region. And the particular focus of the organization in Tunisia was the repeal of the penal code that allows for up to 3 years imprisonment. There, you know, are continued arrests. There was a group of young people last year who were arrested but acquitted ultimately. And in Lebanon, you know, I do see that there's been progress, again, initiated by organizations working within Lebanon, who conducted a campaign called Tests of Shame that were specifically focused on ending these forced anal examinations. And they certainly had some success, at least in the physicians and the justice ministry issuing directives to stop these tests. Of course, there are still other kinds of abuses that occur within detention for those people who are unfortunate enough to be caught up in the various raids against LGBT people in Lebanon.
And Esra Al-Shafi, I wanted to ask you, you know, the show is about lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender rights. Are each of these groups, are they viewed sort of similarly in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, or are there sort of different challenges for women, for men, for transgender people?
I think here it's sort of all viewed as the same. I mean, we're all regarded as deviants regardless, but they do take cross-dressing in particular is a punishable offense. Being gay in and of itself isn't. So there are different consequences depending on how out you are and how you wish to express your identity physically.
You're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Today we're talking about LGBT rights in the Arab world. We're joined by Graham Reed of Human Rights Watch, Esra Al-Shafi, a human rights activist in Bahrain who runs a web community for LGBT people in the Mideast, and Anton Issa of the Middle East Institute. If you're interested in more about this and other undercovered international issues, visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you can read our recent interview with a gay rights activist in Egypt who talks about dealing with his family's marriage expectations and the recent flight of his gay friends overseas. We're also on social media. You can like us on Facebook, subscribe to our YouTube channel, or follow us on Twitter at GlobalJourn. Anton Issa, I wanted to hear from you about the impact that ISIS has had on this discussion. ISIS has posted videos online of them hurling allegedly gay men off the top of a building, killing them as punishment for being gay, essentially. How has this affected the overall cause of gay rights in the Mideast?
Well, it touches briefly on what Salim said earlier in terms of, the perception of homosexuality in the Middle East, specifically amongst conservative and radical elements within the region. This isn't just limited to ISIS or Jabhat al-Nusra or Al-Qaeda. It's also the Saudi government, the Iranian government, a lot of mainstream forces within the region who are conservative and radical see homosexuality as Western cultural import. And as a result of that, it's part of a grand conflict against you know, American values, Western values that they perceive to be detrimental to their to indigenous Islamic values and what they perceive the region should be like in terms of Sharia law and so forth. So in other words,
this kind of video, in a way, it's actually geared or targeted at a Western audience, and that's sort of inflaming Western perceptions.
It's geared towards those who share that kind of view, in the sense that we have Islamic values that need to be protected. This is what these Islamic values are. It is not, and anything outside of this spectrum is a Western import here to corrupt us. And that includes homosexuality. That includes attire. That's why you have dress codes in Iran and in Saudi Arabia, for example. And so it's part of this. It's not a unique thing in the region. It's tapping into a deeply held kind of perception amongst conservatives and radicals of what Islamic values are and what Western values are and where they see the threat coming from.
But does this not also spur backlash amongst other people who may be uncomfortable with LGBT people, but then seeing a video of them being hurled from the top of a building might actually make them say, well, you know, I may not be comfortable with this, but this is absolutely horrific?
Sure. I mean, look, I mean, that's part of also ISIS's, you know, propaganda. It's trying to do shock, you know, to shock audiences, and that's to create fear and so forth. But for the LGBT community in the Middle East, we've been dealing with harassment and assault for a long time, so it's not necessarily out of the ordinary. And when you have governments of the region who actually punish homosexuality, this isn't kind of, you know, it's not shocking in that sense. It's just kind of following a pattern that's been going on for quite, you know, a number of years. But I just also wanted to tap onto what Graham and also Salim were saying about Lebanon. I mean, I was in Beirut at the time of the 2012 raids, and I just want to put this in a bit of a context in the sense that, yes, while we didn't see much movement in terms of police behavior, what we did see as a result of those raids, which kind of backfired on the authorities, was this huge public awakening and discussion about homosexuality, which we've never seen before in Lebanon. I mean, I come from a Lebanese culture. It's always been a very taboo subject to discuss anything about sexuality, let alone homosexuality. And all of a sudden, these raids kind of put into the spotlight of the community in the country the discussion of homosexuality. What is it? Where did it come from? You know, we didn't know that gays existed in Lebanon. Now there's an awareness across the country that homosexuality does exist. And we saw media outlets debate each other on the nightly news in regards to how they perceive homosexuality, whether it's a human right or not a human right. You had LBC, one of the main networks, come out and actually designate an Arabic term, homosexuality, which no Lebanese media had done.
Well, Anton, let me stop you there, because I want to turn this to Graham Reed, because we're speaking about these incidents of these raids on cinemas in Lebanon where dozens of men were arrested. There was actually something quite similar that happened in Egypt a couple years ago. Graham, can you tell us just a little bit about that? I believe there were dozens of men that were arrested at a bathhouse.
That's right. And it was 26 men who were arrested at a bathhouse, and there was a complicity. Well, it was basically a setup by a media journalist who went in with the crew and televised the tipped off the police and televised the subsequent arrest. So it had the effect of exposing people publicly, you know, in a totally intrusive fashion, implicating and alleging that they were involved in homosexual activity. I mean, many of the people who were arrested were subject to their forced anal exams. We've documented and interviewed some of the people who were arrested in that raid. They were subsequently acquitted, and there was an attempt to take some charges against the television producer, but that in the end it didn't come to anything.
But in effect, what happened there was that the men were ultimately acquitted, and there were charges brought against the television journalist, I guess, for violating their privacy. And so in some ways, there is the sense that the public or public opinion sort of turned against doing these sort of exposés, these forced outings of people. Is that not the case?
I think there was a recognition that had just gone too far, that it exposed people, implicated people in allegations, and kind of subject them to a form of public humiliation. I think that what we are sort of alluding to here are some possible positive developments that come out of negative circumstance. And also, you know, in Lebanon, there have been a couple of judgments in which the judges have interpreted the law to say, well, the law outlaws unnatural behavior and homosexuality is not unnatural, so therefore the law doesn't apply. I think also in terms of the kind of spectacle, that spectacle of ISIS executions, you know, was the subject of the first ever UN Security Council ARIA on the topic, the deliberate targeting by ISIS. And I think the statement by Jordan there was very significant and positive in terms of the fact that both condemning, of course, the atrocities by ISIS, but also contextualizing it in a backdrop of laws and hostility towards homosexuality across the Middle East.
And I'm sorry, let me bring in Esra Al-Shafi here, because I wanted to hear from you, particularly with respect to where you see things are going in the future. 5 years ago, I think many LGBT activists in the Middle East thought that things would be much different than they are today. Where do you see things going over the next 5 years?
Well, I don't want to be entirely pessimistic, but in Bahrain in particular, things are not really looking that well. You know, we are in a much more difficult place than we were before 2011. We have to be extra cautious because of our close ties to Saudi Arabia as well. So in many ways, they're importing a lot of their policies on homosexuality here, you know, to improve diplomatic ties with Bahrain. I will say, though, that we are a lot more active. We're a lot more vocal than we used to be. And that's not something that is going backwards again. I mean, once you unlock the potential of the people, there's no going back. So we are taking a risk in doing this, but I think we're doing it for our community and for the things that really matter. And we know that we're alone in this, because I just wanted to bring up one more thing that Salim brought up earlier, which is that it's important that we tell our own stories and our own narratives, and that we're not here sort of to be used as agenda points for foreign governments to justify occupations that often destroy our lives, not assist us. So it's important to highlight how, you know, there's not a lot of LGBT organizations in the region accepting money from places like the U.S. State Department. And because it's these funds and sponsorships are not about our justice and our dignity, but it's about foreign diplomatic interests that are political and arguably corrupt. So this is something that we find increasingly challenging. It's not just, you know, gay people versus governments, but it's gay people versus a huge and growing Western agenda to take over our narrative, and that's something we need to own. And that's why we took to the internet to amplify our own voices.
We're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist. Our thanks to Salim Haddad, Graham Reed, Esra Al-Shafi, and Anton Issa. Our assistant producers this week are Domenico Zapponi, Renee Hickman, and Rachel Foster Gimbel. Elisa Blyle is our graphics editor. Our producer is Vera Tan. Pat Akers of KBIA is our audio engineer. Travis McMillan of RJI is our studio director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.